Good day, Thomas Jefferson Hour podcast listeners, and let me be the first to wish you a happy 4th of July.
The 4th of July this year, I'll be spending it in London, of all places. I will be with my child in London. We thought it would be interesting. You know what we're going to do on the evening of the 4th of July? We're going to go to the Globe Theater, recreated.
Wow.
And we're going to see Romeo and Juliet.
Well, travel safely.
In London. Well, we're a little apprehensive, but not much. You know, you can't live your life that way.
No, it's a dangerous world, and I'm
you know, you're much more likely to be struck by a bread truck. than anything else in life. And so you know, we're going to have a great time, and we're trying to think of what we can do in London that night after the play that doesn't make us look like goofy Americans, but still to say something to each other, have a drink, salute, wave a little flag, whatever it is. But liberty matters. You know, the 4th of July matters.
This week, we do our annual homage to the 4th of July and President Jefferson.
Well, you know, we were talking on this show with Gay Wilson, who's the chief historian at the Robert H. Smith Center for International Studies at Monticello. And she said something in our little interview that really struck me, David. She said, you know, he wanted to be remembered for just three things. And one of them was the Declaration of Independence. So, of course, it's the birthday of the American Republic. It's also a day that Jefferson had reason to be especially personally proud of because he wrote, by any measure, one of the handful of most important documents in the history of the world. Think of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if we devoted enough time to that or not.
Well, usually we do. We spend a lot of time on the writing of the Declaration, how Adams talked him into it. The meaning, the preamble, the 18-point indictment.
We talked more about what went on at the White House this time around, and the Margaret Bayard Smith letter that so aptly describes.
And the five Cherokee leaders who were there, that had to be something,
and
David.
And the sideboards of
imagine all this food and drink, fine wine, the great Virginia hors d'oeuvres, I suppose
you
would call
them. We didn't get into it this year, but one goes back to newspaper accounts of that period. 4th of July was a big deal. And I mean, even by our standards today, it was you hear this parade, and I think it was 1788 in Philadelphia, and there were 5,000 people in the parade. It was a big deal.
Well, see, for us, it's now kind of a holiday of exuberance and family and so on. But then it was about the fact that somehow we had managed to declare independence of the world's superpower, and we were in the place of that superpower, we were creating an experimental republic that bordered on a utopian idea. And so if you think of the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution or, you know, these great moments in human history when people think we're free at last, now we're going to create something unprecedented in the history of humankind, that's how they felt. And you know, it's hard for us to get more than a little sense of that on our 4th of July, but they really believed it right to the core back then.
With that, we will go to the show. Before we do, I just want to take a moment and thank all of you who have decided to support the Thomas Jefferson Hour. As you have heard us say before, the Thomas Jefferson Hour is listener supported. We have no corporate sponsors. We don't get any sort of regular sponsorship from anybody but our listeners. And we have a vehicle for those of you who would like to support the show, and it's called the 1776 Club. Pretty clever.
Appropriate for the 4th of July.
And we're always gaining new members. If you'd like to help support the show, either through that or a donation or whatever you wish to do, we are immensely grateful. Go to jeffersonhour.com. You can find out all the information you need there. And we do have some notable new members in the 1776 Club.
It's growing.
One of you whom you will hear from because—
On a program soon.
Yeah, if you're a 1776 Club member, you get some of the behind-the-scenes extras. And there's bunches of stuff coming up there, but we should get to the show. I've rambled long enough. Just wanted to say thank you and encourage you to consider supporting the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Thanks, everyone. We're so glad you're on board, and keep listening.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and seated across from me, I am pleased to say, is President Thomas Jefferson. Good day, sir.
Good day to you, citizen.
And Mr. Jefferson, let me be one of the first to wish you a happy 4th of July, sir.
Thank you, sir. It was the 2nd of July when we declared independence of Britain. But 2 days later, the Congress of the United States adopted my Declaration of Independence. And that date, for reasons that perhaps don't make sense, certainly did not make sense to John Adams, became the commemorative date of our independence movement. And I have a special feeling about the 4th of July because I was the fortunate one who was called upon by the Continental Congress to write the principal draft of the statement, which is now universally known as the Declaration of Independence.
For those citizens who do not know, it is a well-known fact, Mr. President, that you said the only birthday you shall ever celebrate is that of the United States.
True. My own birthday is of no consequence. Everyone is born sometime. You know, we don't get to choose these things, and I don't believe in astrology or anything else that might affect such an arbitrary moment on the calendar year. And the calendars change, as you know. The calendar of the British-speaking world changed in the 1750s from the old Julian calendar that went all the way back to the Roman Republic and the Gregorian calendar that came about during the Reformation. And so my birthday could be celebrated on the 2nd of April or on the 13th of April, but it could be a completely different system. It could be a Mayan calendar or a Muslim calendar or a Hindu calendar. These things seem, on the whole, silly to me. But the 4th of July is not only the day of the birth of our republic, but it is also one of the pivotal handful of days in human history. You know, I think in some sense that 5,000 years from now or 50,000 years from now, people will look back and say the 4th of July, 1776 was when the age of freedom was born into the world. And although there were setbacks and some countries came later than others, the 4th of July represents a new idea about how humans must be respected in the world, that their rights must be regarded and protected, and that the freedom of the planet, in many respects, pivots on that day in Philadelphia, in the colony of Pennsylvania, in the colonial system of the United States under what was up till that moment British rule.
Mr. President, as I struggled to understand why it was that you would not celebrate any birthday but that of the United States, I found a letter that you wrote to your Attorney General, Levi Lincoln, in August of 1803, and you said, quote, "Disapproving myself of transferring the honors and veneration for the great birthday of our republic to any individual or of dividing them with individuals, I have declined letting my own birthday be known and have engaged my family not to communicate it."
Yes, that sounds a little stern perhaps, but
it does.
In the old world, the king's birthday in France or Portugal or England was celebrated with flattery and people genuflecting and bringing pompous gifts and much ceremony and parades and a silliness, you know, that puts too much aggrandizement on any single individual, and it shows a spirit of unnecessary humility and subordination on the part of a king's subjects. So I wanted to break with that. George Washington let his birthday be known. I thought that was a mistake. People were constantly asking me for my birthday and also hoping that they could then either declare a holiday or, you know, shower me with flattering speeches or whatever. I simply thought that that was not in keeping with our idea of a people's republic.
You thought that if your birthday was known or George Washington's birthday was known, that that may diminish the importance of the 4th of July, or citizens may choose to share the 4th with celebrating Washington's birth or yours?
I didn't particularly think that, but I thought, let's keep the focus where it belongs. So what's the idea of America that deserves deep celebration? Not the fact that George Washington was born on such and such a day, or that Patrick Henry had his birthday in 1 month rather than another. Those are not very interesting things. I was even a little skeptical about a long period of mourning after the death of General Washington in 1799. That upset a lot of people who wanted to wear black and declare days of mourning and, you know, make a pretty big thing out of his end. It seemed to me that we should honor him. He certainly was, if not the greatest American, one of the handful of greatest Americans. He will be remembered as long as there are advocates for liberty in the world. I think it's almost impossible to exaggerate Washington's importance for helping to establish our country. But to go too far with this in ceremonials, to make him a kind of a hero beyond the normal bounds of humanity, I think is a mistake. I think that our focus should be on freedom, the little flame that we lit in Philadelphia in 1776. It seems to me infinitely more important than the fact that John Adams was born in 1 month and I was born in another month.
You did, however, encourage a rather large celebration. Now, my understanding is that President Adams was the first president to occupy the White House over the 4th of July. He didn't really organize any sort of public celebration, but you did, sir.
I did. I opened the White House twice per annum for public receptions, once on the 4th of July for reasons that are clear, and then on New Year's Day because it was that pivotal day of Janus, the Roman god who looked both before and after. And so it seemed like instead of having a Christmas reception, which would be in some regards a violation of the wall of church and state, it would be more intelligent to have a New Year's Day celebration because there's nothing sacred about that day. It's really just a day in mathematics. It's a calendar day. And so I did those two receptions per year, one on January 1st and one on July 4th, and people looked forward to them. There's more respect for that which is more rare, for one thing, and it doesn't involve any single human being. I didn't want them to come to celebrate me. I wanted them to come to celebrate liberty. And because the world of Washington, D.C., you say I was the first president to be inaugurated there, the second to live in the White House. The Adams lived in the White House for a time. Washington, D.C. was essentially a howling wilderness without proper hotels or taverns or bookshops, et cetera. And so people looked to the White House for the main source of hospitality in the District of Columbia, and I was glad to provide it in a minor way, 2 or 3 days a week for a company of diners at the White House, but for the public, for a broader public, twice per year.
Mr. President, there's a woman, Margaret Bayard Smith, who has left us a written account of that 4th of July in 1801. I would assume that you would call her a reliable witness.
Yes, she was the wife of the publisher of the National Intelligencer, and although we met under slightly strained circumstances, we became very close friends. And she was, I want to put this really delicately, she was enamored of me as a national leader. You know, not personally enamored of me, of course, but she had a kind of a crush on a Republican president of mild manners and who believed that nature was beautiful as she did and who wanted to read his job description in a very modest way. And so she, along with Dolly Madison, was one of the social arbiters of Washington for decades. And she kept a diary and wrote famous letters, and I'm frequently the subject of them, at least between 1801 and 1809.
According to historical accounts, it says that, Mr. Jefferson, that you opened the White House and you greeted people, including diplomats, civil and military officers, and five Cherokee chiefs on that day.
Well, depends on the 4th of July. Which one are you talking about?
Well, this would be 1801, sir.
The first of them, then. Yes. Well, As you know, when I sent Lewis of the Lewis and Clark expedition into the West and others on similar journeys, Zebulon Pike to Minnesota and Colorado, and Hunter and Dunbar in Arkansas, and Freeman and Custis in Texas, and so on, I was trying to fan out with these exploration parties so that we could begin to fill in the great canvas of the American West with data, latitude and longitude, and the location of Indian tribes, and the confluences and tributaries of rivers, what sort of mountains were there, were these lands suitable for agriculture or for mining or what. So I was wanting to do this sort of grand enlightenment inventory of the American West, and the principal of my proteges in this respect was Meriwether Lewis, who was a neighbor of mine in Virginia and who lived with me for more than 2 years in the White House. And one of the things that I instructed Lewis and other explorers to do was to try to convince leaders of these tribes to come to Washington, to come see the Great Father, as I was called, as all presidents were called. And so Lewis dutifully did encourage tribal leaders from all the tribes that he met, but particularly the consequential tribes like the Mandan and the Hidatsa and the Lakota and the Shoshone and so on. And some did. And so I was frequently entertaining Indian chiefs, sometimes at other receptions, but whenever I could include them, on the 1st of January or on the 4th of July, I did. And in fact, the great Mandan leader, Sheheke, the white coyote, was at my New Year's reception in 1807, January 1st, 1807, and he was accompanied there not only by his wife and an interpreter and their children, but he was accompanied by Meriwether Lewis to that reception.
Mr. Jefferson, we need to take a short break from this conversation. When we return, I'm wondering if you would be willing to read Mrs. Smith's account of that 4th of July in 1801 and perhaps check it for validity.
Well, I don't want to blush, sir, but yes.
I thank you, Mr. Jefferson. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. And this week we're speaking with Mr. Jefferson about the 4th of July, particularly about a 4th of July in 1801.
My first. I was inaugurated on March 4th, 1801, after, as you know, a hotly contested election that wound up in the House of Representatives. And so the first time I had a chance to entertain the public was that 4th of July.
We had been talking about a written account of the 4th of July. Now, for people who don't know to what extent you opened the White House, I said that the north grounds of what was then called the President's Park or the Commons were filled with people. There were tents and booths, crowds of people, food and drink and cottage goods of all types. There were horse races, parades, quite a festive day, sir.
Yes, not unlike a county fair, perhaps, or you know, some other day of fireworks and speeches and athletic contests and races by horses and so on. These things occurred with some frequency around the United States in my time, particularly around the time of the county fair or a county election, but in this case, I was able to draw some of that to the already emerging national holiday, the 4th of July.
It is said, sir, that people witnessed you as, quote, a bareheaded Jefferson with his gray locks waving in the air, and you were watching from the steps of the White House.
I tried to keep a certain detachment. I looked on benignly and encouraged all of this, but the president does not want to make himself too familiar. There needs to be just a certain slight sense of, not aloofness, but detachment from the multitude to preserve the dignity of the office. And it also, of course, squared with my own introversion. I'm an extraordinarily shy man.
Mr. President, would you be willing to read that that article, or actually it's a portion of a letter, and perhaps add your own commentary to it?
I will do so, sir. The letter, I believe, was written by Margaret Baird Smith to her sister, Mary Ann Smith. About 12 o'clock yesterday, the citizens of Washington and Georgetown waited upon the president to make their devoirs. We found about 20 persons present in a room where Mr. Jay, surrounded by the five Cherokee chiefs. After a conversation of a few minutes, he invited his company into the usual dining room, whose four large sideboards were covered with refreshments, such as cakes of various kinds, wine, punch, etc. Every citizen was invited to partake, as his taste dictated, of them, and the invitation was most cheerfully accepted, and the consequent duties discharged with alacrity. The company soon increased to near 100, including all the public officers and most of the respectable citizens, and strangers of distinction. Martial music soon announced the approach of the Marine Corps of Captain Burroughs, who in due military form saluted the president, accompanied by the president's march, played by an excellent band attached to the corps. After undergoing various military evolutions, the company returned to the dining room, and the band from an adjacent room played a succession of fine patriotic airs. All appeared to be cheerful, all happy. Mr. Jefferson mingled promiscuously with the citizens.
You mingled promiscuously, sir.
I know that sounds a little less honorable in your time than it did in mine.
Perhaps it was a poor choice of adjectives.
No, the word was used differently then. What Margaret Baird Smith means is that I didn't hold back. I went out and greeted people, and that there was no ceremony. People didn't have to come up and wait in line to meet me, that I made myself available in a somewhat informal way to everyone who had gathered on that occasion. So promiscuously is a positive term in the letter, although it would be seen in, I think, a rather different light in your time.
It was a very happy day for you then.
It was a happy day. The 4th of July, my first time as president, these Indian chiefs, five Cherokees who had come in to meet the Great Father and to learn something about our, I hope, benevolent principles with respect to the future of the continent. I was the one who named the Marine Corps Band to be the president's particular source of music. I did it largely, of course, they were good musicians, but I did it also as a cost-saving device because the Marine Corps had a band, and I could call upon them as the commander-in-chief to make music on occasions of this sort. And then to think that there were all these events going on around the White House, the grounds were still in a highly unfinished state, and the Capitol was really a Capitol in potentia rather than one that was groomed in anything like the excellence that you assume in your own time. And then I always tried to provide extraordinary food and beverage so that people who came to the White House under my watch came away admiring the wines and believing in the profusion and the elegance of the things that I offered by way of food. So, yes, and of course, add to all of that, that even though I tried to be extremely modest about my own place in American history, I am, it has to be said, the author of the Declaration of Independence. And it was that birthday, the unanimous adoption of that instrument, that document that we were celebrating on the 4th of July.
Food has been talked about. It's reported that you had what were called sideboards loaded with food. What kind of food would a citizen find in the White House on the 4th of July in 1801?
Well, lots of desserts, because it's hard to keep meat hot enough. Certain types of food really need to be served straight from the oven or the fireplace. There were meats, but there were many cakes and pies and loaves of things, sweetmeats. So a profusion of desserts. There would be what is the equivalent of crackers and cheese. There would be probably cold ham, cold cuts, you would say, enough that everyone felt that there was adequate food, that it substituted for a meal, but it wasn't a meal. And then on an occasion like this, I wouldn't bring out the best wines because you're, of course, serving several hundred. But the wines were great. They were the best wines that most people had ever drank, and I was very proud of that. But I didn't serve five, six, seven different varieties on an occasion like this because you have to economize on behalf of so large a reception.
And you did this every year, sir?
Yes, I did for the 8 years that I was president, have these two receptions per annum. And as you know, shortly hereafter, the sideboards would be supplemented by the world's largest cheese.
Of course.
The world's largest cheese came in from Massachusetts, and it's not easy to eat the world's largest cheese in any short order. And so I was able to bring it out, properly trimmed, of course, for different receptions at different times. And it became something of a, I won't say a tourist attraction, but very nearly so. People would come to the White House and say to a servant, is it true that the president has the world's largest cheese? And if so, might I see it or have a sample of it? And occasionally my servants would roll it out. It was on a Lazy Susan sideboard. They would roll it out and people would marvel at what was left of what had once been the world's largest cheese.
Mr. President, I'd like to ask a question. In the terms of my day, who picked up the tab for this party?
Sir, you insult me.
I didn't intend to, sir.
Of course I did. I was paid a princely fee as president, $25,000 per annum. But that was meant to cover all the expenses of hospitality, all personal expenses, my secretaries, office supplies, furnishings, you name it. Whatever pertained to my administration needed to come out of that extraordinarily large salary. The average salary of an American was $400 or $500 per year, if that. And so I had this enormous sum, but at no time would I ever have passed on the expense of such a thing to the taxpayers of this country. In other words, I could have pocketed all $25,000 had I wanted to and never had a single reception. That obviously would not be good hospitality. And so all of these fees came from my own funds, my own salary.
Sir, a gentleman could go far into debt with a philosophy like that.
And indeed, sir, I did. I spent about $4,000 for my first couple of years on wine alone, and I don't think I can adequately add up what you would call the grocery bill, the cost of the dinners. Some of the furnishings were eventually paid for by a small fund provided by the Congress, and some of the landscaping too, and those were things that would stay with the house long after my departure. But a lot of it was my own. I left things there when I departed in March of 1989, but I don't think much about these things. Money is important, but it's certainly less important than almost anything else in the pleasures of life. I should say a word about the Indians who came. Imagine how exotic that was. I encouraged them to come in full regalia, if they had headdresses to wear them, if they had moccasins to come in those. They did not speak English. Perhaps a handful could understand a little English, but they usually had an interpreter. And I took great joy in having them there. They were a little out of place. They sometimes found it hard to make sense of the style of the white people of the early 19th century in Washington, D.C. But I wanted them there for a couple of reasons. First of all, I wanted them to enjoy my hospitality. I wanted to meet privately with them. I gave speeches, and those speeches are extant of what I said to the Indians who came to meet with me at the White House or at other times during my life. I wanted and this is going to sound a little perhaps Machiavellian, but I wanted these Indian representatives from the West to see the power, the wealth, the opulence, the population density, the architectural splendor of our civilization, because when they did, I hope that they would want to join us, that they would want to follow us down that path, the path towards settled agriculture and permanent villages and metallurgy and literacy and so on, because, as you know, most of the Indians of the West were nomadic. But secondly, and this is the part that perhaps sounds a little strategic, but I wanted them to see that whatever else is true, there was no future in their armed resistance to the purposes of the United States.
So you wanted them to see the power that the United States had?
Yes.
That's a bit uncharacteristic for you, Mr. Jefferson.
Well, this is what's known in your time as soft power. I wasn't parading armies in front of them. I wasn't shooting blanks at targets. I wanted them to see that our numbers were essentially infinite, that we had a very advanced civilization, that we kept coming. There were more immigrants coming to this country all the time. I wanted them to see that while they may resist our presence in their lands one way or another, that it would not certainly be in their interest to wage war against us because our numbers were too many and the instruments of violence that were at our disposal, you know, muskets and rifles and blunderbusses and small cannons and so on, were such that their bows and arrows would never be able to compete if it came to war, which I hope it never does.
Is it safe to say, sir, then, that this celebration was representative of all of your 8 years at the White House?
Yes, they would all have been more or less of a piece. The ones early in this, I suppose this is true of almost every president, the ones early on were a bit tentative, but they were very celebratory. And then we established a routine, and that routine followed me to the Madison administration and the Madison administration to the Monroe and so on. But once we sort of got into a rhythm with it, then there would be a kind of high water period between 1802 and 1806, perhaps. And then in the last couple of years of my presidency, they were more muted. To a certain degree, I think like almost all presidents, I ran out of energy. I mean, I think almost every president is somewhat worn down by the length and the rigors of two terms. But also, at the end of my second term, we were caught in a world crisis with Britain and France, the embargo crisis. And essentially, we were being pitted by each of the great belligerents against the other in the continuation of the Napoleonic Wars. And so this was not really a time that I felt much like celebrating. And so we had these receptions, but they were much quieter in those dark years at the end of my second term than they would have been during the high water mark of my administration.
You were invited back to celebrations after you left the presidency. If I could go ahead to the year you died, sir, 1826, a Roger Waitman was corresponding with you. He really wanted you to attend. You couldn't for reasons of health, but you wrote just a beautiful letter to him declining, and you talked about how you wished you could be there to congratulate personally the small band, quote, the remnant of that host of worthies who joined with us on that day in the bold and doubtful election we were to make for our country.
Yes, that was the last letter that I ever wrote. About 10 days before the 4th of July, 1826, and I knew that I couldn't go. My health was broken. I was dying. It was in the last weeks of my life, and I knew that I would never leave the environs of Monticello again. I might never leave my bedroom again. But, you know, I must tell you the truth. Had I been 75 years old on that occasion, I don't think I would have gone to Washington. I think when you're done, you should retire with dignity. I don't think that it's a good thing to return again and again to the public stage.
Oh, but the people loved you, sir. It would have meant much to citizens to see you.
Possibly, you know, when Lafayette in 1824, came on his farewell tour of America. By now his health was broken and he was corpulent, and it was clear that he could not live much longer. And he wanted to come one last time to the New World. Washington was dead, and many of the people, Hamilton was dead, many of the people that he had associated with during the Revolution were gone. But we had been friends, not only in this country, but more particularly during my 5 years residency in France. And Lafayette came to this country, and he made a broad tour of America to see once again the land of his youth, but also to say goodbye. And he came to Monticello, and I had been prepared for this. And on that day, the stories are quite moving. I was crippled up by rheumatism and my own elderly maladies, and he was much more crippled up than I was because he was carrying so much weight. And so he was allowed to step out of his carriage at the great circle in front of the house, and I came down the steps in a very hesitating and elderly way, and we shuffled quickly towards each other and embraced and wept in each other's arms for the revolutions that we had seen and the extraordinary world in which we had been permitted to live and work. And so I understand what you're saying, but I'm not one who thrusts himself into the public very often. And once I left Washington, perhaps you know, but I never went farther than Richmond for the last 17 years of my life, and Richmond only once.
Thank you, Mr. President. Before we end our conversation, I would be remiss if I did not ask you to recite those words that you wrote for the Declaration of Independence. I think it's so important to recall them on this day, the 4th of July.
It would take 20 minutes to do all of it, but I can give you what I think is the portion to which you advert. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
And a happy 4th of July to you, Mr. President.
And a free one, sir, to you.
We're going to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Jefferson. But our conversation with President Jefferson ends now because we have two very special guests to talk to about the 4th of July at Monticello.
People from the great plantation itself.
And the first person we have on the line is Gay Wilson, somebody I think you know.
A friend of mine, Gay Wilson, who is the director of the Robert H. Smith International Center for Jefferson Studies at Monticello.
Hello, Gay. Thanks so much for taking time to talk to
us. Welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Gay.
We wanted to talk to you a bit about what goes on at Monticello to celebrate, recognize the 4th of July.
Well, it is a very busy and interesting day here. In that we have a naturalization ceremony in the morning, and it's held on the West Lawn. And this is an occasion. It has been going on for, since 1963. We've had more than 3,600 people who have taken the oath of citizenship here. This is for it's an actual court being held outside, and it is presided over by the U.S. District Court, the Western District of Virginia. And we usually have 70 to 75 people who are being naturalized at the time. It's quite an exciting time, and it's always wonderful to see the variety of people who are wanting to become citizens. And then at the end of the program, they're given an opportunity to express some of their feelings about becoming a citizen, about, you know, reaching this state of being a U.S. citizen. And that's often very moving, because it makes you appreciate more the fact of your own citizenship and how fortunate some of us have been to be born here. And we take it so for granted. But it's a very moving ceremony. It's a very moving day. So that gives you a little bit of overview of the high point of is, of course, the naturalization ceremony itself.
Gay, if I were from Honduras or from Hungary or anywhere in the world, and I had the chance to be naturalized somewhere in America, and that place became Monticello, I would be just absolutely thrilled. It must be one of the great moments of the year there.
Oh, it definitely is. Very definitely. So it's a very festive day. We have tours of the house. It's free and open to the public. You just have to get here early and make sure you're up on the mountaintop by 9 o'clock when the official ceremony begins. But it really is a very moving day. And we always have a very large crowd, even last year when it was raining. And like I say, there are tours of the house. We celebrate by serving some ice cream, which we think that Jefferson did serve it on the 4th of July. We know that he had an open house on the 4th of July when he was president. Not here at Monticello, we're talking about in Washington. But he saw this as a very important day in our history. And so he always had an open house to which all the citizens were invited. And we have reports of a variety of people that would appear at the president. Then they called it the president's house. Today we would say the White House. But there were a variety of people there. And there's reports, too, that he intermingled quite freely with them. And so we can imagine that was a very festive day that he held in Washington during his presidency. And so we've tried to incorporate that spirit here at Monticello as well, that it's a joyous occasion. You know, it's an occasion to celebrate. And for those of us that were born citizens and for those that are becoming citizens.
So we like sometimes to quote that funny letter from John Adams to his wife where he says the 2nd of July will be the day that's celebrated and there'll be fireworks and speeches and parades and so on, off by 2 days.
That's true. He missed it just a bit in that he thought that was going to be the important day. But Jefferson himself always looked to July the 4th and began to remark upon it early on. Of course, and as you probably know, he wasn't immediately recognized as the major author of this document. I mean, of course, those in Congress had known that he was the head of the committee. He was the chief draftsman. But it wasn't so much publicly known until it was, many years later.
I think 1800, that election was the first time it was widely understood that he was the principal writer.
Mm-hmm. By the elections that were taking place in the late 1790s, of course, the first time he was really put forward was the election of 1796, which, of course, he lost to John Adams, and then, of course, the election of 1800, which brought him into office. But by that point, he was definitely recognized as the principal author of the Declaration. And those who did back Jefferson, his Democratic Republicans, or Jeffersonian Republicans, as they're sometimes called, they very much like to point out the fact that he was the principal author of what by that time was a very iconic document. And so we know by the late 1790s, he was very, very much looked at as the primary author. So it was something that came to be attached to his name, and something, of course, as I'm sure you already know, he was very proud of. And of the three accomplishments that he asked to be put on his gravestone, one of them was that he was the author of the Declaration of Independence. And so something he felt very important and a great achievement in his life.
Our only regret is that we can't be there. It sounds like just an absolutely wonderful day with some solemnity, but a great deal of pride in what Jefferson did and, of course, what Jefferson's principles continue to guide this country, particularly with respect to the naturalization of new American citizens. What a wonderful job you have, Gay Wilson.
Well, it's never boring. I can always say that because I always often say to people when I'm out giving public talks, you know, whether you think you like, well, what we know of Thomas Jefferson or not, I can always say he's never boring. He's a very deep, a very interesting person. And I think, and if you're really honest about it, I think you've got to say he has left us a lot. And a lot of this is, I think, our different freedoms, you know, our freedom to participate in politics through the vote, our ability to have different views on religion. And he believes so very strongly in these things. And I think he has left us a fantastic heritage. I don't think you can deny that. So, yes, it's a fantastic place to be, and especially on the 4th of July.
Gay Wilson, thank you so much for taking some time today to talk to us. And let me be one of many to wish you a happy 4th, ma'am.
And from Monticello, I wish you a happy 4th as well. Bye-bye.
That was great fun. I just so wish we could be at Monticello for this solemn and beautiful ceremony of naturalization. But we also had the chance today to talk to another of Monticello's staff. Normally when we talk to our friend Pat Brodowski, the head gardener there, it's about garden-related issues. But the 4th of July is bigger than that at Monticello. It's a very important day at one of the most extraordinary shrines to human liberty, isn't it, Pat?
Yeah, you know, it's extraordinary because it is a moment when it's free to the public to come in. And we have up to 4,000 people sometimes on the West Lawn. And there is a naturalization ceremony for about 60 citizens. So they transform the West Lawn into an actual courtroom, and they have the presiding judges. I think maybe there's 6 or 10 judges, and they're all sworn in. And then they go through the ceremony of giving citizenship to these new people. And then the most touching moment is when those new citizens can get on the microphone and describe the ordeals they went through and the effort they put into becoming a citizen. It makes you really excited that you didn't have to do that, that you were here already, and that they made such an effort, and they're so excited to be here in America. So it's really a very affirming kind of ceremony. It's marvelous.
It's the perfect place on a perfect time of the year, the 4th of July, the day that Jefferson gave us the Declaration of Independence, also the day, of course, that in 1826 Jefferson died in his bed at Monticello, and to think that it becomes this annual platform for the naturalization of 60 or so new citizens. It's an incredibly moving ceremony,
yes,
isn't it?
It is. It's very moving. And you realize the strife that some people go through, and all of the things we have that we take for granted that they do not have, and they truly want to improve their lives. Anybody in the world wants to improve their life, and here in America you can do it, so they want to be here. It's really, really very exciting.
Not to make any political points, but when you hear what they go through, even in the naturalization process, what they must know mm-hmm. to become citizens of the United States, they often are more adept at civics than our native-born citizens are.
I fear that's true.
So these recent immigrants are there, and they're chosen for this, and it's there's a good deal of solemnity to this occasion, and then we get to hear their stories. Does the garden play a role at all on this day?
Well, since it's on the West Lawn, the flower garden is, you know, on view, so it's really important. It's meticulously weeded for the days leading up to the 4th of July. It's at its peak. And then, of course, a lot of people come to the vegetable garden, too, but it's, it's down a few levels and not quite as the house is the focus, the house and the gardens around the house. So, it's okay, but it's not in the forefront.
It could be a pretty hot day too.
Well, yes. It's in the afternoon. It's pretty hot.
Jefferson didn't like that much heat. You know, he was he preferred heat to cold, but he was really a temperate man.
Yeah, they wrote down when it was like 96, and I'm thinking 96.
We'll take that.
We'll take that. You know, 110. That's when it's bad. Does get hot out there. And I think the, his design of the garden was to increase the heat by having that bank that reflects heat and absorbs heat for later And it's such an exposed location. There's no shade. So, you know, that was intentionally planned, but it does, you know, add about 10 degrees to the garden at all times. Whereas the west lawn has shade trees and you can get in and out of the sun. It's much more restive.
So, Pat Brodowski, what I hear you saying is that if there are people who are within distance of the Little Mountain, that on the 4th of July, admission is free, and they might just get a chance to observe this extraordinary naturalization ceremony on the West Portico.
Right, and they have a special guest speaker, so every year there's a highlight of a speaker for the 4th of July, plus the naturalization ceremony, yeah.
Now, we're delighted. We'll check in with you as the harvest begins a little later in the year, but we're thrilled that you're now one of our regular correspondents. And thanks, Pat, and have a great yourself 4th of July weekend.
All right, thank you.
It's always great to hear from Pat Brodowski. But now, sir, it's time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
People are always surprised that I'm lukewarm about the 4th of July. For the first 20 years of my life in tights, I usually wound up somewhere reciting the Declaration of Independence on the 4th of July, but in more recent years, I have ignored the big day the way Jefferson tended to ignore Christmas. This year, I'll be landing at London Heathrow on July 4th, and I'll spend that evening at the reconstructed Globe Theater watching Shakespeare's Twelfth Night with the person I love most in the world, my 22-year-old daughter, occasionally a guest host on the Thomas Jefferson Hour. When people ask me what is the best way to celebrate the 4th of July, I'm always a grim Puritan and a downer. I say, have a discussion with your friends and family about the status of liberty in the United States. Talk about your aspirations for American civilization, what would restore us as the world's template of freedom, due process, enlightenment, and the pursuit of happiness. Take turns reading and discussing the preamble and the peroration of the Declaration of Independence. You can see why I tend to spend the 4th of July alone. Even my closest friends, after hearing this buzzkill litany, are likely to quote Sir Toby Belch to the joyless Malvolio in Twelfth Night. Dost thou think because thou art virtuous there shall be no more cakes and ale? The 4th of July is now to America what Saturnalia was to ancient Rome, a day, now a weekend, of excess, misrule, irresponsible antics, Roman candle duels, gorging, drunkenness, law-breaking, and sunburn. Don't get me wrong, I like 5 consecutive bratwursts as much as the next fellow, and 22 beers, and jet ski jousting, and late night swaying and high-fiving renditions of Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA, followed by, I love you, man, and passing out on the beach. But I always remember, about when the rednecks are shouting that the Second Amendment is the most important of them all, and sneaking firecrackers down each other's swim trunks, that Mr. Jefferson told us that the price of liberty is actually eternal vigilance and mastery of the political dynamics of our republic. Personally, I have found it hard to be vigilant after 5 gin and tonics, my cousin's patented Vesuvius nachos, 4 s'mores, and 2 flagons of box wine besides a Great Plains lake at 97 degrees and the wind gusting to 24 miles per hour. I've had some great wild and crazy 4th of July at Lake Tahoe, at Yellowstone National Park, on the Missouri River in the middle of nowhere, at a place called Lake Chida in western North Dakota, and at my grandparents' farm in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. This year, at a time when Europe is enduring a nihilist Islamic terrorist attack about once every 5 weeks, flying to London for the 4th of July may be as good a declaration of freedom as anything one might do. My mother has asked me to reconsider spending days in London at this particular juncture. She is, of course, infinitely more concerned with the safety of my daughter than with mine. I have had second or third thoughts about the trip myself. But you know, the cliché is right. If we stop living our lives in the ways that make us thrive, the terrorists win. Western civilization has spent 3,000 years working out the kinks of tribalism, creed, ideology, nationalism, militarism, racism, sexism, and ethnic discrimination. Since the Berlin Wall went down in 1989, we have seen more international harmony in the West than at any previous moment in human history. More mobility, fewer border restraints, more pan-European harmony, and constructive engagement. And peace, by the way. I'm deeply saddened by Brexit, by the hardening of borders around the world, by the new anxieties, suspicions, and even profiling that we're seeing.
Donald Trump was elected here as much by our growing anxiety about Islamic terrorism as by any other electoral dynamic. I do not want us to move towards a more restricted concept of civilization. We must fight our urge to become Fortress America. So I'm going. My daughter, who is rightly a little nervous, is meeting me, and if we die watching one of Shakespeare's most exquisite comedies, that itself will be a statement about the tenacity of human freedom. Besides, I've been reading the Oxford-educated Israeli scholar Yuval Noah Harari's Homo Deus. In this remarkably important book, Harari says if you live in the first world, you are dramatically more likely to die of type 2 diabetes than from a terrorist act. To all of you, whether you spend the 4th of July sipping Bordeaux and talking about Locke's second treatise on government, or guzzling beer upside down through a funnel on the back of a pontoon, I do join Citizen Greenwood in saying, God bless the USA, as well as the rest of the world made possible by the little flame lit by Thomas Jefferson and the Band of Brothers on the 4th of July, 1776. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.